At this spot on the 25th of June, 1759, Britain's James Wolfe gets his first view of the French fortress of Quebec. He has 100 days to conquer it. Today, it's Quebec's most famous park. Then it was a hilly cow pasture owned by Abraham Martin. On these few Canadian acres, a battle was fought that decided the fate of two empires. That set the stage for the American Revolution, that guaranteed Quebec would be French and the vastness of North America, English.
Good fire. I think it resonates because it is a story full of larger-than-life characters, flawed characters, doomed characters. And there's so much legend woven into the story.
For many Quebecers, this was a conquest so dreadful that Wolfe is still reviled as a war criminal.
C'était vraiment brûler, détruire. Pour les Canadiens, c'est la catastrophe. Il y a pas une famille qui a pas subi un effet de cette guerre-là.
On the French side, the general is equally controversial. Did Montcalm throw victory away by insisting on big army tactics instead of the guerrilla warfare so successful for insurgencies? There is still a great mystery. How did the British move an army downriver 14 kilometers and scale this cliff with 4,500 men, virtually undetected? A team of scientists and historians find some revealing answers. The battle fought here on the hilly plains of Abraham is a decisive moment in a much larger war. Some call it the French and Indian War, others the Seven Years' War. But it's now clear that it is truly the First World War. Two superpowers, England and France, confront each other across continents and oceans, fighting for supremacy. Before it ends, the war will have spread from England and the European continent to India, Africa, the Americas, and the Caribbean Sea. But the most crucial battle will be fought at Quebec. Our story begins in the French countryside with a retired French colonel whose luck has suddenly taken a turn for the better. On the 3rd of April, 1756, at his country estate at Cunziac, France, Montcalm bids his wife and five children goodbye. He has been a soldier since the age of 9, a regimental captain by 16. Wounded many times as he rose to the rank of colonel, he is not as sprightly as his earlier years. Historian and retired general of France, Jean-Pierre Poussou, says Montcalm is chosen first for his bravery, but then it gets complicated.
Montcalm est un militaire qui sait parfaitement distinguer. Mais il a été envoyé au Canada pour deux raisons. Première raison, c'est que tous les officiers généraux auxquels on a proposé le poste ont refusé d'y partir, en disant que ce n'était pas un commandement digne d'eux.
Suddenly, Montcalm has been called from retirement and given the task of defending France's North American colonies. He is made a general. He and his family are promised a large retirement package, whether he lives or dies.
Donc voilà pourquoi il part au Canada. Mais on a désigné quelqu'un qui était effectivement dans la hiérarchie militaire tout à fait de second rang et qui surtout, c'est un point tout à fait important ceci, n'avait jamais commandé face à l'ennemi.
It is simple. Threatened at home, France can spare little to defend far away Canada. Montcalm has no idea what he is in for.
La défense du Canada n'est en rien une priorité pour Louis XV. Elle ne peut pas l'être. Elle ne l'aurait été pour aucun roi au demeurant, pour une raison extrêmement simple. C'est que les priorités françaises sont les guerres continentales.
For 150 years, the French were welcomed by the Indian nations. The French made treaties with them, traded furs, even intermarried with them. The rivers of North America are their highways. By 1759, the leadership of an estimated 150,000 Indians is allied with the French. New France dominates the map, with Indian alliances and forts keeping at bay 13 English colonies with 1 million Americans along the eastern seaboard. In 1759, New France is dismissed as a few acres of snow by the French. Canada has become a drag. The fur trade is maintained to keep the Indians on side. But it's no longer the immensely profitable venture it once was.
Ce qui caractérise la Nouvelle-France, c'est qu'elle ne coûte pas très cher, mais qu'elle ne rapporte pratiquement rien. Donc l'intérêt de la Nouvelle-France est un intérêt essentiellement stratégique.
In all of New France, which stretches from Quebec to New Orleans, there are only 55,000 French-speaking citizens. The people of New France have no inkling. They are about to become strategic pawns in a global war. The officer chosen by England to drive a sword through the heart of New France is the 32-year-old James Wolfe, soon to be the youngest major general in the British Army. A Renaissance man, steeped in history, fluent in French, and skilled at tactics. An officer since the age of 12, in battle after battle, he has proven himself a skillful strategist. His letters demonstrate a soldier who knows his profession inside out.
A little weak on that right side.
More practice.
A glass of water?
Sure.
You asked what your brother must study to become a good soldier. He may begin with the King of Prussia's regulations for horse and foot. Saint-Rémy, for all that concerns artillery. Of the ancients, Caesar, Thucydides, Xenophon's Life of Cyrus, and the retreat of the 10,000 Greeks.
Wolfe is a very professional officer, and he is making waves. Artists are busy depicting his leadership of an amphibious landing which led to the capture of the French fortress at Louisbourg, a gateway to the St. Lawrence and Quebec. Wolfe has caught the eye of Britain's grand imperialist, its parliamentary leader, William Pitt the Younger. Pitt persuades England to spend a fortune building the best navy in the world. A navy that can ferry and fight with a new British army. This is the British Empire's creation moment, observes historian Colonel Roman Yaramovitz.
The British can pick and choose and become strategic, like nailing them in India, sending Clive off to do great things and capturing a subcontinent, hitting them in the West Indies, all those sugar islands, and of course going after Canada. So it's a global war, not only in its size, but also its Olympian design.
Its idea is strategically bold. England and Europe, he says, will be fought for in North America. Wolfe is appointed to take command of the Quebec expedition, but Wolfe is unsure he is up to the job. Illness is his Achilles heel. Some historians argue he is suffering from tuberculosis, consumption, for which there is no cure.
I have this day signified to Mr. Pitt that he may dispose of my slight carcass as he pleases, and that I am ready for any undertaking within the reach of my skill and cunning.
There are even rumors that Wolfe is insane.
What's that great line? that the King of England gives when someone tells him, well, they're thinking of promoting Wolfe. You can't possibly promote this man. He's mad. And the King says, mad, is he? Well, I hope he bites some of my generals. Because Wolfe performs.
Before departing to assault Quebec, Wolfe has conquered the heart of Catherine Lowther. She is from the nobility, beautiful and fabulously wealthy. Before he sails, Catherine gives him her portrait and a locket of her hair. On his safe return, they plan to marry. Wolfe has the greatest reason in the world to stay alive. He is in love. It is the summer of 1758. A French army is awaiting the approach of an immense English force. These are called the Lace Wars, where how you looked was as important as how you fought. While Wolfe was gaining fame capturing Fort Louisbourg, Montcalm was here on the banks of Lake Champlain at a fort the English called Ticonderoga, the French Carillon. Fort Carillon guards Lake Champlain and the western waterway to New France. If the French army breaks here, the path is open to Montreal and Quebec City. Montcalm constructs an abattis of wood and brush, an 18th century version of barbed wire, and places his army behind this defense line. A 16,000 strong English army attacks head on. Montcalm's forces are outnumbered 4-1. The French fire into the English ranks steadily. The British are shot to pieces. France's General Poussou is an expert on Montcalm and what the French call the Battle of Carillon.
La bataille de Carillon a en quelque sorte fait la gloire de Montcalm. Et à partir de là, par rapport à ses soldats des troupes régulières, Montcalm apparaît comme un général en chef de grande valeur.
Letters and journals from the time reveal that Pierre Rigaud de Vaudreuil is not impressed with Montcalm. Born in Quebec, Vaudreuil is the governor, appointed by France the overall commander. But France has put Montcalm in charge of the army. Both men believe they are in command.
Bonjour, Monsieur Montcalm. Je vous préviens, il n'est pas question de céder, ne serait-ce qu'un arpent de la Nouvelle-France, sans nous battre.
Monsieur, je suis lieutenant général des armées du roi, et à ce titre, Sa Majesté m'a demandé de défendre la Nouvelle-France. Je suis seul en charge de la stratégie militaire.
Monsieur de Montcalm, moi, je suis gouverneur de la Nouvelle-France. Et à ce titre, je dois défendre Québec et l'ensemble du territoire.
Si vous le permettez, je vais vous montrer quelle est ma stratégie.
Vous voulez parler de bataille traditionnelle?
Oui, monsieur.
Nous faisons depuis 140 ans une guerre de harcèlement que nous appelons la Petite Guerre, avec succès. Et depuis 2 mois, nous harcelons les Anglais. Avec succès, les petites victoires que nous avons faites sont peut-être des petites victoires, mais sont mieux qu'une grande défaite.
Monsieur,
la guerre face à face, nous n'avons pas les moyens de la faire.
Monsieur le gouverneur, je ne suis pas ici, en Nouvelle-France, pour me battre comme vos miliciens. Nous faisons la guerre, il faut la faire selon les règles. Une armée face à une armée. Votre tactique de harcèlement est indigne de l'art militaire.
Guerrilla warfare is called the little brother of war. The Europeans are appalled at their Indian allies, who see scalping as a sacred act. Today it's called asymmetrical warfare, using terror to unnerve a more powerful opponent.
Vaudreuil was born in Canada. who understands the Canadian Francais as well as the units there, feels that this is perhaps the best way of conducting a war against a Continental Army. You see much the same thing again in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, how do you defeat superpowers? Well, you fight them in ways that they're not prepared to fight.
Monsieur, vous devez retenir vos sauvages, ils n'obéissent à personne. Et quelle horrible réputation il faut aux armes du roi avec leurs immondes et puantes chevelures.
Oh, mon ami.
Soldat anglais.
Montcalm does not comprehend what Vaudreuil knows, that without the Indians and their terror tactics, the war would have been lost decades earlier. The financial cutbacks imposed by the French court are making relations shaky.
Faites un bon usage.
Lorsque l'on parle de l'Empire français, on fait en général une erreur historique véritable. C'est un empire français vu d'Europe, mais pas du tout pour les tribus indiennes qui n'ont jamais considéré qu'elles avaient en quelque sorte donné ces territoires aux Français.
Indian leaders back the French because the French keep their word. They distrust the British American colonists who want their land and will lie, steal and kill to get it. In the spring of 1759, the first ship of the season is spotted coming up the St. Lawrence. It arrives with Antoine de Bougainville. He brings captured documents showing that a giant English armada is on its way to Quebec.
Il décrit toute la stratégie des Anglais.
And there will be no help from France.
Leur objectif principal est de prendre Québec cet été.
De Bougainville is a favorite of Montcalm. Historian Denis Vaugeois.
Bougainville est un bonhomme supérieur, mais c'est un vrai officier. Donc, il se comporte ici. Il y a des moments chez Bougainville de guerre en dentelle. Donc, une relation avec les officiers britanniques qui fait qu'on est entre gentlemen et puis on s'envoie des petits cadeaux, des petites choses. Mais ça, c'est la tradition dans l'armée, hein? On va se tirer dessus le lendemain, mais la veille, on peut presque trinquer ensemble. Il y a beaucoup d'incidents comme ça.
The armies that appear on the Battle of Quebec are basically European armies who have absolutely no interest or affection for Canada. The French have no love for the French Canadians. They don't particularly like them. They often treat them cruelly. The British couldn't care less. These are condottieri. They are professional armies. They arrive. They could have been, you know, fighting south of Paris or London. They happen to be fighting outside of Quebec.
Vive la France!
Vive la France! Vive la France!
De Bougainville will one day become a great explorer, rivaling Britain's Captain Cook. He even has a flower named for him. He is only 29 and has the reputation of being quite a ladies' man. Incredibly, it may put him and all of New France in peril.
Nos victoires et nos conquêtes.
Absolument.
In early June, the British fleet enters the St. Lawrence, beginning a 1,000-mile journey upriver to Quebec. This tall ship leads one of the biggest fleets assembled in British history. 49 warships armed with 1,871 guns, manned by 13,500 soldiers and seamen, as well as 140 merchantmen carrying the army's supplies. Aboard are 2,100 Royal Marines, equipped with 134 landing craft. The fleet is so vast it stretches 100 miles down the river. In the far distance, Quebec is in sight, but there is a challenge.
Coming up river, Quebec is intimidating. The Indian word allegedly is where the river narrows, and it does. Suddenly, the widest river in the world becomes a doorway, and a very narrow doorway.
Here the French are counting on the river itself for defense. They are convinced that below the surface, treacherous currents and shoals will destroy the English ships, especially at the traverse. Here the river splits. The upper channel to the north becomes impassable. The lower is dangerously narrow, and below the surface, a minefield of hidden reefs. The French have removed all marker buoys. They did not count on the Pembroke and its master, James Cook. One day he will become legendary, mapping the Pacific. At Quebec, he is part of a team of navigators. They sail ahead of the Armada, sounding the traverse from longboats, carefully mapping every hidden obstacle.
A quarter less than seven!
We're not used to the idea of a map affecting the course of history, but this one of the traverse opened the door to Quebec. Naval historian Victor Southern says Cook also found an ingenious solution for the fleet to navigate the narrow channel.
They found the traverse, not much wider than the beam or the width across the largest warship, the 90-gun Neptune, and what he did was anchor the longboats themselves as buoys with their bows in and their sterns facing out, and the British warships had to sail through that very narrow line of longboats just off the east end of Ile d'Orléans. It must have been a majestic sight, one by one, these huge vessels moving up silently through this narrow channel. And when they arrived in the basin, there was a moment of astonishment for the French, who didn't expect that that kind of naval achievement could occur. But it also was a moment of revelation for the British, because after virtually voyaging 1,000 miles into the interior of the continent, suddenly there was their objective. There was the citadel sitting ahead of them, seemingly impregnable, glittering in the distance, as it were. So for both sides, it was a moment of dread or surprise or revelation, but certainly a moment of high emotion.
Mais que diable font donc tous ces Anglais ici?
It is certainly a moment of high emotion for Montcalm, who has been assured such an English feat is impossible. Our best seamen and pilots, he says, seem to be either liars or ignoramuses. Wolfe is not happy either. He was planning to attack the shoreline at Beauport, beside the city, but discovers that the French have it well defended. Wolfe has 100 days to conquer Quebec. After that, the fleet must sail for England to escape being iced inland. Montcalm has to keep the English at bay, off balance, even get lucky and burn their fleet. For the wooden ships of the time, fire is the greatest peril. Two nights after the English arrive, the French slathered 7 old ships with tar and set them afire. Naval historian Victor Southern.
Fire ships were assembled up near the mouth of the St. Charles River, and then on the ebb tide, they were let loose to come down through here. And the idea was they would sweep down on the British vessels. In each case, the French ignited them too soon, and the British sailors were actually, in one case, able to row out with their longboats, put grapnels into them, and tow them off onto the shore. And the longboats managed to haul them out just in time, saying things like, "Damn, Jack, did you ever take hell in tow before?"
Montcalm sardonically observes that it is the most expensive fireworks he has ever watched. Ongoing archaeological digs at Quebec City reveal history's small details. Bombarded and burnt walls from Wolfe's siege of the city in 1759. Montcalm's army is entrenched north of Quebec. Wolfe lands his army and cannons across the St. Lawrence and begins a bombardment so fierce it foreshadows the aerial bombing of Germany in the Second World War.
Fire!
Wolfe does what Bomber Harris does to Germany, Wolfe does to Quebec. Basically, we'll start off with the heavy bombardment. Batteries of troops leveling the city. What possible military use is it to level Quebec and to blast these buildings apart? You're not killing any of Montcalm's troops, but you are forcing the people to leave. You're destroying homes.
the constant shelling of Quebec, the fires, that is demoralizing.
By the time it's over, the cathedral and half the city will be reduced to blackened stone and burnt timbers. Historian Denis Vaugeois.
La vérité, c'est qu'il s'est acharné. Je pense qu'assez rapidement, il s'est senti comme impuissant. Et là, ils ont bombardé pour bombarder. Hein. Ils ont bombardé la ville comme ça se peut pas. Ils bombardaient des civils.
But if you summon the place to surrender and it doesn't surrender, then you can bombard it. And the civilians in Quebec have been evacuated, as French sources themselves tell us. By the time Wolfe was really subjecting Quebec to a heavy bombardment, there were very few civilians in it. So I think if you're going to accuse Wolfe of war crimes, we have to get this into proportion and to think what a war crime really is. Otherwise, you're diluting the term.
Ils ont incendié une vingtaine de villages sur la côte du sud, ici, des deux côtés, du côté est et ouest. Là, c'était vraiment brûler, détruire.
He did it because he was hoping that by doing this, he would force Montcalm to come out and do something to stop the ravage, as he describes it in his letter to Pitt. So there was actually a reason for what was done. Now, did Wolfe massacre civilians? Was this some bloody rampage through the St. Lawrence Valley? No, it wasn't. There's no evidence for that at all. What there is evidence for is that Wolfe specifically mentioned, repeated in his official army orders, any man who harms a woman or child will face death.
Precipitated by his own officers, Wolfe is about to face a leadership crisis. Midsummer, Wolfe's frustration is mounting.
My antagonist has wisely shut himself up in inaccessible entrenchments so that I can't get at him without spilling a torrent of blood, and that perhaps to little purpose. Montcalm is at the head of a great number of bad soldiers, and I am at the head of a small number of good ones that wish for nothing so much as to fight him.
The 31st of July, 1759. Wolfe looks for a weak point in the Quebec defenses. He launches an attack at Montmorency Falls. Unable to get his big ships with their cannon close enough to protect the landing, everything goes wrong. And as he fears, a torrent of British blood is spilled. 210 killed, 230 wounded.
François?
The stress on the 32-year-old Wolfe begins to tell.
I am not well.
Montcalm is holding out brilliantly. Wolfe's health is not. Preparing to fight a battle that will settle the fate of North America, Wolfe is in constant pain.
From his early 20s, Wolfe was suffering from what his contemporaries refer to as the gravel, which is a kind of an accumulation of crystals in the bladder, something akin to kind of kidney stones. We know from Wolfe's own journal, he's being tormented. His bladder is sadly racked. He's suffering this terrible pain.
François, the chamber pot.
And we know from a contemporary report which is sent back to one of Wolfe's friends in England that soon after arriving in Quebec, Wolfe was passing bloody water. His urine was tainted with blood.
Some historians argue Wolfe is slowly dying of consumption, incurable tuberculosis, and so was suicidal, seeking a quick end, a glorious battlefield death. Historian Brumwell says this portrait, done at the time, is not the picture of a dying man.
If you're dying of consumption, you don't get sent to Quebec in command of a major operation.
So he wasn't well, but whatever it was that was afflicting him, he'd learned to deal with, he'd learned to contain.
Wolf's trio of second-in-command officers doubts his leadership. Brigadiers Monckton, Murray, and Townsend. The ambitious, artistic Townsend did these cartoons of the red-haired wolf and circulated them among the officers. Some reek of Townsend's upper-class view of the middle-class wolf and a certain amount of jealousy. Historian Yaramovitz, an artist and cartoonist as well as a retired colonel, says it is practically a court-martial offense.
Can you imagine one of Caesar's legionnaires showing cheap and snotty, derisive cartoons? It's unthinkable. And here, one of the great commanders of the British Army in his own officer's mess, here is one of his trusted brigadiers passing around insulting caricatures that poke fun and ridicule his commanding officer. They're a difficult group to command and control. They probably could be brought to heel if Wolfe had a plan to produce results. Wolfe doesn't. His first major operational effort is basically Dieppe, landing at the Beauport shore and being massacred.
Wolfe is concentrating his operations below Quebec because his big ships and their cannons cannot get up the narrows of the St. Lawrence past the city. The French and their cannons command the heights, and the prevailing wind is blowing west in the wrong direction.
Right now we're passing through the narrows, which are right below the bluffs of Quebec, the highest point of the rocky formation on which the fortifications were built. And this was the most dangerous point. It was here that Holmes, our Rear Admiral Holmes, attempted to move some of the ships upriver to do a landing upriver. Using flood tides and using east winds at night, they managed to get vessels as large as the Sutherland and other smaller frigates upriver, at least as far as Cap Rouge.
Montcalm must now defend territory stretching from the Beauport shore on the east, Quebec City in the center, and Cap Rouge to the west. The 7th of September. Aboard a sloop mischievously named the Terror of France, Wolfe is searching for a place to land his army. He goes back to a spot discovered earlier in the summer.
Master Cook, what might the possibilities be of a landing over there?
The cliff is steep, but it's close to the city, and Wolfe is desperate.
I think that might do the job, sir.
On the St. Lawrence, just to the west of Quebec City, Wolfe's landing spot, the Foulon Cove. It's so dangerously steep that the French officer commanding atop the cliff is convinced, like his superiors, that there is no threat.
On ne peut supposer que les Anglais aient des ailes pour traverser, débarquer, grimper la falaise, puis les murs en une seule nuit.
Here is the plan. While some Navy ships launch fake attacks along the Beauport shore, pinning down Montcalm and most of his army, Wolfe will float on the tide in a series of longboats from the anchorage at Cap Rouge to the landing spot at Foulon Cove. Led by Townsend, the generals deride Wolfe's plan.
Everyone down the line, I think, at some point went, we're going to go where? At night? And do what? Okay. And your plan is?
What is that?
Sir, the latest rubbish being passed around.
My brigadiers. Two cowards and a villain.
One of the great unanswered questions of history. How did Wolfe do it?
I calculate that from this point.
Wolfe has intelligence from a French deserter that he is not sharing with his brigadiers. Half of Montcalm's army is at Cap Rouge with de Bougainville. At the Foulon Cove, most of the French guard has been allowed to go home to collect the harvest. As well, There is a radical new theory about Wolfe's approach to the attack and why he picked the night of September the 12th, 1759, to carry it out.
A number of historians were concerned with Wolfe's reputation. The fact that many people had written about him as being a largely inept commander who had largely stumbled on his victory really needed to be put to rest.
Some 250 years later, when the river conditions were exactly the same as the eve of the invasion, a boatload of nautical scientists and historians proved that Wolfe's maneuver was far more than a piece of luck.
So what these historians did was, using modern technology, including GPS technology, they essentially recreated that voyage. They departed from the anchorage at St. Nicolas at approximately the same time, on a night where you had the same conditions of moonlight, same conditions of tidal flow that Wolfe had on September 12, 1759. And they found that they arrived at the Anse-au-Foulon, the landing site, at exactly the time when Wolfe, in fact, arrived, and as Wolfe probably had planned. That suggests that there was far more intelligence and planning on Wolfe's part the night of September 12th than has been recognized up till now.
Conditions on the night in question were unusually good for exactly the kind of operation that was planned, and the position of the moon was also very favorable for troops coming down the river.
Beyond the French fortifications, the moon rose, illuminating most of the river. But the shoreline on the left is shadowed by the cliffs. This is where Wolfe's flotilla will come.
Wolfe's selection of the night of September 12th was masterly. He picked not only the appropriate time for tides, he also picked the night when the moon effectively amassed his operations from the vision of any watching sentries. It was a remarkable stroke.
Wolfe writes his fiancée, sending back the portrait and lock of her hair. Some say he was either suicidal or had a premonition.
Any idea that the Foulon operation was some kind of harebrained suicide mission, some kind of Wolfe death wish, just doesn't really stand up. I think what we've got is a carefully planned, risky, but carefully planned, highly professional operation, which is a gamble and will depend on luck, but then again, what military operation doesn't depend on luck?
Now fades. The drama has poetry. Wolfe admires a poem called Gray's Elegy. His fiancée had given him a copy. His officers testify that on the eve of the battle, he recited the poem from memory, with a surprising finale.
The boast of heraldry, the pomp of power, and all that beauty, all that wealth e'er gave, await alike the inevitable hour. Paths of glory lead but to the grave. I would rather have written those words than take Quebec upon the morrow.
A single lamp is lit on the flagship, the signal for Wolfe's force to board their landing craft. The signal to slip downriver to Quebec will be two lanterns. At the heart of the plan are very human soldiers. For even the bravest, the prospect of battle triggers a well-known response. A blow or bullet to a full bladder boosts the risk of infection if it bursts. The action shows the tide has turned towards Quebec City.
I believe we have our tide.
With precision and in silence, boats carrying the lead force of 1,800 British soldiers begin a journey into history. The next few hours will decide who will rule North America and most of the world. While Wolfe is approaching above Quebec, Montcalm's forces below the city firing away at fake English attacks designed to confuse the French general about where the real assault is going to come.
Montcalm is called the Old Fox, but as the hours march towards a decision, he has no idea what Wolfe is up to.
Ma chère femme, je suis inquiet et je dors peu. Il y a tant de choses dont je dois m'occuper. Je suis débordé et je perds souvent patience. Sa Majesté me paye pour que je ne perde pas patience. Je ne dois pas l'oublier.
Wolfe ayant joué au chat et à la souris avec Montcalm. Montcalm jouait le jeu, mais reste que c'est énervant, parce que finalement, l'initiative allait venir de Wolfe. Fait que là, t'es toujours en réaction. Et tu te demandes si c'est une simulacre d'attaque ou si c'est la vraie cette fois-là. Il était probablement au bout de ses nerfs.
Suddenly, a wall of rock and trees looms up before them. Out of the night comes a challenge from a French sentry. Qui vive? Yells the French sentry. Who goes there? La France. Vive le roi, answers the Fraser Highlander.
Through a combination of luck and chance, the French had been planning to send a convoy of supply boats downriver on the same night. And the contractor who was sending the boats down canceled that voyage at the very last moment. But what he forgot to do was to send a message to the French commander, Bougainville, upriver, and who would pass it on to the sentries, that the trip was canceled. So the sentries were expecting a passage of French boats.
An officer records the exact moment of the landing, 4:04 a.m. The first English boats overshoot their landing beach by 400 paces and land on a rock beach, facing a cliff so steep it seems straight up.
I do not think we can by any possible means get up here. It might indeed be a forlorn hope, but we must use our best endeavor. Softly, gentlemen, softly.
Undaunted, the young Scotsmen practically bound up the start and then relentlessly pulled themselves and two cannon up the shale face, their boots slipping but holding onto shrubs and branches. This landing place, ever since known as Wolf's Cove, is less than 3 kilometers from the walls of Quebec. By their general, whose afflictions have been swept away in a surge of adrenaline. Caught by surprise, the defenders die on the spot. One escapes, determined to alert Montcalm.
Si l'on peut parler d'un exploit, c'est là qu'est l'exploit. L'exploit, c'est d'avoir réussi à faire monter près de 4000 hommes le long de la falaise, avec les armes, le matériel et même 2 canons, et sans que les Français s'en soient rendus compte et dans des conditions absolument épouvantables. Pour faire une comparaison, on peut dire qu'il faudrait songer, par exemple, à certains aspects du débarquement américain de 1944. Véritablement, on a quelque chose d'assez comparable. On a une troupe qui est obligée de monter littéralement comme des chèvres, en quelque sorte, une falaise. Et là, ça a été tout à fait remarquable.
Across Abraham Martin's pasture, Wolfe sets out with a screen of soldiers to find the best place to confront the French. Were the French about to spring some trap? Some thought Wolfe was digging his own grave, putting himself between Bougainville at Cap Rouge and Montcalm at Quebec City. Or would he bury the French in that grave?
Or in God's name of the French,
by finally, after all these months, forcing them into battle.
Have the men form up at the tree line.
Ah, Bigot.
Monsieur le Marquis.
Comment ça va? Ce sont des coups de feu?
Ah oui, monsieur, ils viennent de l'autre côté de la ville. Mais ne soyez pas inquiets, nos alliés indiens recevront leur dû.
Allons, mon garçon, calme-toi.
This soldier has run 8 kilometers from the spot where Wolf landed. His message that Wolf and his army are ashore is not welcome.
Mais c'est impossible! C'est pas croyable!
By 7 a.m., Wolf has landed 1,500 soldiers. By 9 a.m., with the support of the big warships, the Navy is ferrying another 3,000 redcoats across the St. Lawrence, where they climbed the battlefield above. Governor Vaudreuil prepares a dispatch, alerting Bougainville of the landing.
Il a nos meilleures troupes à Cap Rouge. Comment il peut débarquer une armée entière à Lens-au-Foulon?
On croirait entendre mon calme. Je l'avais averti à propos de Lens-au-Foulon. Vous savez ce qu'il m'a dit? Faut pas croire que l'ennemi est des ailes.
No sign of the French yet. Advance the front 400 yards.
Done, sir.
Montcalm was heard to whisper, "There the British stand where they ought not to be."
Ils se tiennent là où ils n'ont aucun droit de se trouver.
Mais il ne peut pas le croire. Et c'est là qu'il commence à s'énerver. Ça n'a pas d'allure. Il fait venir ses soldats au pas de course, hein, pour venir se ranger en face des Britanniques qui ont quand même eu quelques heures de repos. Là. Ils sont rendus en haut, ils ont pu prendre leur position, nettoyer leurs fusils, chanter un petit peu, faire un peu de musique. Les autres arrivent à bout de souffle. Puis là, c'est une armée indisciplinée parce qu'il y a même plus de Canadiens, de miliciens dans ces troupes-là que de réguliers.
By Wolf's fake attacks, Montcalm's exhausted army marches to the battlefield. This original map, referring to the Heights of Abraham, depicts the position of the opposing armies. Wolf's 4,500 men in red, and in front of the walls of Quebec, Montcalm's army in blue, with a force of similar size.
Phasers, prime and load.
Wolf has ordered every British soldier to load his musket with 2 bullets. Forty paces from the British line, a stake marks the killing zone. No matter how many are shot down, the British troops will not fire until the French reach this spot.
L'armée française est prête au combat. Alors il y a au milieu les troupes régulières, il y a sur les côtés les miliciens, et également il y a dans les flanquements assez boisés et broussailleux, il y a des Indiens qui sont chargés d'attaquer sur les flancs l'armée ennemie.
Montcalm orders the Indians and his Quebec militia to harass the British line. At least 300 British soldiers will die or be wounded of sniper fire before the battle even begins.
what the British brought particularly to the whole question of linear tactics was an enormous discipline, the capacity to remain patiently waiting in an ordered formation, even while you're under fire. The British were supreme masters of that.
The French and Indian sniping did the most damage at the far ends of the British line. Wolf promenades. His nonchalance steadies the men. He walks the front line, chatting casually. Wolf demonstrates absolutely no concern in the face of enemy fire.
Je crois qu'à ce moment-là, il a fait preuve de beaucoup de flegme, beaucoup de, c'est ça, de flegme. Et il contrôle ses troupes. Et les troupes ne bougeront pas, ne tireront pas, tant qu'il ne donnera pas l'ordre.
Troops, lie down! Freezers, rise up!
For Bougainville and his elite force, or does he attack before the British are entrenched?
Le gouverneur nous supplie d'attendre Bougainville, mais c'est impossible. Wolf a déjà monté deux pièces de canon. Nous ne pouvons pas lui donner le temps d'en monter davantage.
C'est idiot. Il suffit de raisonner un petit peu, et c'est que si Bougainville n'est pas rendu, il n'est pas loin. Hein? Puis lui a quand même des troupes raisonnables, tandis que l'autre, qu'est-ce qu'il va faire, là? Il n'y a pas beaucoup de temps devant lui. Alors il suffit d'attendre. Wolf est vraiment coincé. Il est dans une souricière, là, ici. Là. Il s'agit que l'autre a de la patience. Positionner ses troupes, dire à ses francs-tireurs, amusez-vous. Vous avez des cibles, là. Amusez-vous.
There is a great unresolved mystery. Where was Bougainville? With 2,000 soldiers, his headquarters is at Cap Rouge. He is responsible for defending the territory where Wolf is landing at the Foulon Cove. One popular legend has Bougainville far from his post, in the arms of another man's wife, a certain Madame de Vienne.
Bougainville, after spending weeks of great attention to duty, left Cap Rouge on the night of September 12th to have dinner, and perhaps more, with Madame de Vienne. And that night, Wolf picked to make his landing.
General Poussou supports the official story that it takes time to get an army marching.
Bougainville n'a qu'une mission à ce moment-là, c'est rassembler les troupes pour venir avec un nombre de soldats suffisant, attaquer de flanc ou par derrière l'armée ennemie. Donc Bougainville avait besoin de 2 à 4 heures pour à la fois rassembler ses troupes et pour venir sur Québec.
Si Wolf arrive à se retrancher, nous ne pourrons jamais le déloger avec les troupes que nous avons à notre disposition. Non. Il faut l'attaquer sans attendre.
Il est persuadé que c'est une avant-garde qui a été installée là, et qu'à partir du moment où elle est installée, le reste de l'armée anglaise va pouvoir la rejoindre. Et à ce moment-là, sa grande crainte est en train de se matérialiser, c'est-à-dire qu'il sera obligé de livrer une bataille rangée, par rapport à laquelle il estime que ses troupes sont tout à fait inférieures à celles des Anglais. Le paradoxe étant que, ce faisant, il se précipite dans le piège.
Open fire, but they are too far to be effective.
Jesse!
is a triumph of controlled British firepower. In the centre of the line, two of the battalions, some sort of 700 men there, apparently delivered their fire as one massed volley. Each musket was loaded with two balls. Each of those balls weighed more than an ounce. Now, I'm not a mathematician, but you think about it, 40 yards range, you're pouring in a heavy amount of lead into those oncoming columns.
So in many respects, it had the same effect as the machine gun did in the First World War.
Wolf has made too good a target. A bullet smashes him in the wrist.
Beat the advance.
Differing accounts of the end. It could have been snipers, but more likely a cannon loaded with golf ball-sized shot. Wolf is stuck in the groin and square in the chest. "Don't let the men see me down," he said. Wolf is carried off the field, but after 100 meters, he cannot go on. On the battlefield, it is a decisive moment. As Wolf lies dying, the French line breaks. French-Canadian militia, used to guerrilla warfare, are not trained to hold rank beside Montcalm's battalions, drilled in European style.
By the time the smoke cleared from the third volley, it was evident that the disciplined British fire had essentially destroyed the French formations. It had only taken 10 minutes, but it was 10 minutes that decided the fate of North America.
They run. Look how they run. Who runs? The enemies. They give way everywhere.
Wolf's final order is a command to Colonel Burton, telling him to march a regiment down to the river and cut off the French retreat.
No, God be praised. I die in peace.
The log of His Majesty's ship, Lowestoft, recorded how went the day. At 7, landed all our troops on the north shore. At 10, our troops began a general action with the French. At 11, was brought on board the corpse of General Wolfe. The Fraser Highlanders are closing on Quebec when they suddenly run into withering fire from the French-Canadian militia and the Indians, who stopped their attack, and for the moment, saved the city. But the battle is lost.
Mon Dieu.
British artillery targets Montcalm. Shrapnel tears into his stomach and thigh. But like Wolfe, he tries to disguise the severity of the wound. In fact, he's beginning to bleed to death. His soldiers keep him in the saddle as he enters Quebec for the last time. Bougainville arrives at the battlefield just ahead of his elite force. Far too late. This painting depicts Montcalm expiring as he lies on a mattress in the middle of the battlefield, a rendition comically inaccurate. In fact, even the best-known painting of Montcalm was done after he died, based on his wife's remembrance of what he looked like.
This is the most accurate rendition of the death scene. As Montcalm lies dying, he is tormented with panicked requests for advice from Vaudreuil, who eventually flees to Montreal. About noon, Montcalm is informed that he has only hours to live. He is told the French will formally surrender Quebec on the morrow. His last recorded words.
Voilà qui est bien. Je ne verrai pas les Anglais entrer dans Québec.
That's good. I won't be alive to see the English enter Quebec. Montcalm dies in the arms of his church, but it is also the death of the French regime in North America.
L'important ici, c'est que la bataille des plaines d'Abraham a eu pour conséquence qu'effectivement, l'ensemble d'Amérique du Nord est devenu anglais.
England goes wild at the news of Wolfe's victory. Ironically, the cost of the Seven Years' War leads England to tax the American colonies to pay for it. They revolt, and in 1776, with help from France, stage a winning revolution. Wolfe's fiancée is devastated. Catherine Lowther receives back the locket of her hair and portrait Wolfe gave her on the eve of the battle. In her grief, she burns all his letters. Je me souviens, I remember, is Quebec's official motto. But what is remembered about the battle fought on this hilly pasture outside Quebec depends on where you stand.
C'était une guerre atroce. Il faut pas se cacher les choses.
Wolfe remains controversial. It is little known that before the battle, the young general, fluent in French, wrote out generous terms of surrender, guaranteeing Quebec's institutions, which have remained French to this day.
This is at a time when Catholicism cannot even be practiced in Britain. And it scarcely suggests to me someone who regarded Canadians as vermin, hated Canadians with a passion, and wanted nothing more than to humiliate or to annihilate them. What we've got here is a continuity of key French-Canadian institutions.
This monument was inscribed with the words, "Here died Wolfe, victorious." The monument became the target of nationalists, and in 1963 was blown up. A new monument was erected, but this time the words were changed to read simply, "Here died Wolfe." The word "victorious" was dropped. While nationalists blew up his statue, and in Quebec, some history books have tried to blow up his reputation, England painted over the bad and turned him into a mythic figure.
The painting by Benjamin West, a very famous iconic painting, the Death of General Wolfe, is a very good example of the saying that truth is the first casualty of war. We start to gradually eliminate who we would regard as the intruders, the imposters, the soldier in green, the ranger. Well, we know that Wolfe had rangers at Quebec, but on the 13th of September, his rangers were all downriver on a kind of a ravaging expedition, burning farmhouses. So we can eliminate that ranger. the figure who we know to be Robert Monckton, who has his hand inside his tunic. Well, we know actually Monckton had been shot through the lungs.
Only four of the men depicted in this painting were actually present when Wolfe died. The rest paid the artist to become part of history. The battlefield is a stirring place for Quebec City's chief archaeologist, William Moss.
I'm very moved being here to know that a battle took place here. Several hundred French soldiers killed here. 100 or so British soldiers killed. Thousands of soldiers in both camps, wounded, severely wounded, all around us now. That really touches me as an archaeologist and as a historian.
In 2002, a new memorial was dedicated to the soldiers who died fighting this battle. This sculpture depicts two men fighting to the death, and below, a boat waits to take them across the River of Death. In a trench-like memorial, the names of French soldiers who died in the Seven Years' War are carefully carved. There are even one or two British, Scots who happened to be Catholic. Bones and a skull thought to be Montcalm's were moved to this tomb in a ceremony led by the Premier of Quebec. It is little known that testing later showed that the skull and most of the bones are not Montcalm's. While the French who died on the battlefield are remembered with grace and dignity, those who died capturing Quebec have met a different end. The hospital gardens where the English soldiers are buried have been paved over.
58 British soldiers were killed on the Plains of Abraham. 10 times as many died over the winter. So they were put in mass graves in the gardens of the monastery complex, which is where we are now. The gardens were here in the 18th century. So the mass graves of the British soldiers are under our feet or very near to where we are presently.
The boast of heraldry, the pomp of power, and all that beauty, all that wealth e'er gave, await alike the inevitable hour. The paths of glory lead but to the grave.
History sometimes remembers victors and their paths of glory. As Wolfe studied Caesar, so generals who followed Wolfe studied his amphibious tactics of the Plains of Abraham. Officers like five-star General Douglas MacArthur, who planned a bold landing behind enemy lines in the Korean War, saying, "I will surprise them," like Wolfe at Quebec.